Thanks, Angelos. Hello, Usenix. Happy to be invited. I am here today to talk about Cyber Grand Challenge. We held our qualifying event on June 3rd of this year. We qualified 7 finalists. And before I talk about that, I want to go back to the beginning when we put our broad agency announcement. These are the contract announcement vehicles that DARPA puts on the street as public announcements to request work. So in our introduction, we said we wanted autonomous defense capabilities that had reasoning abilities beyond that of human experts and had the speed and scale of computers. So that is a lofty goal, and I want to scope that goal. We didn't think that this would happen within the program that we were standing up. We just wanted to start people thinking about head-to-head reasoning competitions that could someday be the best experts versus the best machines. And to do that, we had to find a skills competition that was beyond the ability of computers in the realm of computer science. And Capture the Flag happens to be a really good example. It has a history, a 20-year history of being played head-to-head between teams of software analysis experts. It has rules and a tradition. And just like bringing a computer to something like chess or Jeopardy, Capture the Flag seemed like the applied skills tournament to try and bring computers, where we could easily observe that computers were not up to the task now and might be someday. So we've set our sights on that goal. We're doing some research funding in the area to see how close we can get in 3 years' time. And we've promised in our very first announcement a final event where machines are going to play each other in a league of their own. And that's going to be a little less than a year's time from today. Specifically, Thursday, August 4th at the DEF CON conference. But what are we trying to do here? I want to talk about the experimental models that we use to do computer security research. So there are many experiments that fall into this category where you have a negative corpus of things that you want to prevent, malware, maybe attacks on the wire from the intrusion detection evaluation data set, shellcode injection attacks, what have you, and a corpus of benign software. And you either train an approach, a machine learning approach, or you construct an approach that is designed to discriminate the bad stuff from the good stuff. And you publish your efficacy in terms of false positives and false negatives, and you are done. And this is how a lot of really good computer science gets done, and it's also one move in something that we can probably describe as an adversarial cycle. So if we look at what's going on in the world, FireEye published this graph, and what it says is over 2 years they collected about a quarter million malware samples a year and found that the occurrence of these samples in the wild generally lasted 1 to 2 hours. So we are obviously up against an intelligent opponent who doesn't care that we are analyzing and determining that software is malware, and is sufficient to simply change what it is doing faster than we can adapt. So there is a factor of time in these adversarial cycles. This slide comes from NSS Labs, and what it's showing is the correlation of evasion in known attacks against intrusion prevention and intrusion detection products. So little dot evades one, big dot evades many. There's clear evidence that our opponents are intelligent and are downloading defenses and testing against them, and are optimizing evasion not just for one, but to evade the entire available computer security industry. So again, you can see the importance of time. Attackers have a near infinite amount of time to study a slow-moving defense and to productize evasion before attacks are actually launched. So there is the potential to update this experimental model and give the other side a move, to take the negative corpus and the positive corpus and create an approach, and then hand your approach, complete white box, over to an adversary and let them study it, and actually to publish our efficacy in terms of false positives and false negatives on test cases that were designed by an intelligent adversary to defeat you. And this is tougher. It's really tough to do this kind of experimentation. But certainly, the elders of the tribe have been telling us for a long time that computer security might even be a field defined by the existence of an intelligent opponent. Bruce said intelligent, Dan said sentient in 2005, and then in the same essay, he walked sentient back a little bit. He said, well, if your adversary can pipe 5,000 A's into a network service and achieve memory safety violation that grants administrative privileges, you might not be up against a sentient opponent, but you're still in the security business. So maybe sentient is too far. Maybe we just need an intelligent adversary that knows how to defeat security systems. Maybe that adversary looks like this. This is the TechX cyber reasoning system that qualified in the Cyber Grand Challenge qualifying event. Their team picture posted on Twitter during the event. So if we're going to do experimentation with an intelligent adversary, there's some problems with making that intelligent adversary a red team, which is something that I did for a long time. It is hard to be reproducible, to do the same level of adversarial inspection every single time. Sometimes you wake up with not enough or too much blood in the coffee system. So a reproducible intelligent adversary is something that we need for reproducible science. There's also the problem of controls. If you want to go up against two versions of a system, one undefended for a control, one defended with a novel approach, and maybe two more different novel approaches, it is very difficult for a red team to forget. Red teams learn every time that they go up against a system. So the ability to wipe everything that an adversary knows about a system and start again allows us to do controlled experiments. And finally, there's the problem of consistency and scale. You can take whatever auditing firm's metric you wish for lines of code audited per minute, and of course that usually ignores things like complexity. But even so, a million lines of code, it is very difficult and potentially prohibitively expensive for a team of people to reason against even moderately sized projects of that size. So if we want experiments with an intelligent adversary in the loop, the ability to have a move and a counter move, and potentially play that forward to have a cycle and an equilibrium, then we need an adversary that is reproducible, controlled, consistent, and that means machines. And when you want to build machines that can be part of this model, you run into a whole bunch of experimentation problems that are similar to the problems of standing up any type of computer security club, exercise, red teaming training. And the problem is the software sandbox. So you need vulnerable software, and that's often solved with tools like DVL, the vulnerable Linux distribution, intentionally vulnerable software with known bugs, faced up with red teaming tools like Metasploit. But there are some problems with that. The first is that even if you're playing with real-world exploits that are well-known, they still have OS-specific interchangeable components. So you're still playing with something that's real, even in a controlled, isolated environment. Network isolation is incredibly difficult. Mistakes happen. It's sometimes very difficult in an academic environment to get people comfortable with this. Real exploits still work on unpatched systems. I'm at the wrong audience to talk about the prevalence of unpatched systems, we all know. But the big problem is you can't safely do research into novel flaws. Even if you're working on an old build of Linux, there is the potential to find something that is new and requires publication. And so the idea of having a sit-down head-to-head competition where the results are published with reasoning systems on something even like DVL, there is the potential to find bugs that exist in fielded systems, and you have the full disclosure problem, which means that it's really difficult to have an experiment where you're finding flaws and putting and having a system that reacts to them or puts proactive defenses in place real time, publish the results. And that's what we were trying to do at the beginning of CGC. So what we built was not an operating system, but maybe an operating system layer. We call it Decree. We're the government, so we have a backronym. It is the DARPA Experimental Cyber Research and Evaluation Environment. You don't need to know that. But the idea was the world from scratch, right? Everything that you would need to have a binary search for novel flaws with network protocols in real time, where every single flaw that was under the microscope of the opponents existed only in our environment. So absolutely no shared code with anything else in the world. So we have incompatible protocols spoken by now 131 source code available network services, all written from scratch. And when we say written from scratch, we mean we have our own libc, we have our own loader, we have our own everything. Our own incompatible binary format. It is not ELF, it is not PE, it is CGC. And it won't run unless you have a decree sandbox on the system. We have our own ABI. I'll talk more about that later. But it's a very simple set of system calls. And we have brokered networking, which means that simply networking is always initiated by the experimenter, not the experiment. So the idea of something in decree doing network scanning is irrelevant because there is no network to initiate a scan onto. The experiment has to say you will do something that looks like a scan. So network isolation when you're running decree is totally irrelevant. You run this on your desktop. No exploit for decree will ever affect a real-world computer. It is non-reusable in every way. The protocol code is different. So if you want to find a novel flaw in anything in decree, from the loader to the ABI to any of the code we've published, it won't work anywhere else. And your system is both free to instantly use it, and the other side of the experiment is free to instantly defend against it entirely with machine reasoning. And you can publish those results immediately without fear of a disclosure problem. Novel defenses, novel flaws, no problem. So we built this for everybody. It's open source, it's on GitHub. And we hope that it finds use in the community. We've also released the results of our first qualifying round. So machine-generated patches used in competition, machine-generated proofs of vulnerability, the entire qualifying event as it was played out over 24 hours is available for download, repo.cybergroundchallenge.com. You can take this home and take a look at what advanced program analysis was able to do with unexamined software. Because it's released as a Linux layer, it is portable with the modification of just 7 system calls to any host OS that supports basic I/O. And cooked into decree is a measurement capability. So if you're talking about rewriting software, deploying patches, you will often hear that the reason that such things aren't done is because of risk of software damage or software performance loss. Well, these things are measurable in decree. For every single one of those 131 pieces of software, there is also a testing suite, network remote testing suite with complex inputs that test the complete functionality of the software and can give you how much of that functionality was lost when a change was made. We also measure performance in terms of user land execution time, memory consumption, and space on disk. So there's a whole bunch of experiments you could do with this. Ours is just one. You could compare mitigations on various operating systems via source port. You can benchmark the performance impact of various defensive mitigations because it's source, you can compile it and let the compiler introduce mitigations. You could do things like running automatic exploit generation or blind ROP against dynamic defenses or machine learning in the middle. We don't know what the total set of experiments that's possible with this corpus is, but we're releasing it as open source and we look forward to finding out. So, 7 system calls: terminate, transmit, receive, wait, allocate, deallocate, random. That's it. If you're doing program analysis, then you know that one of the really difficult things about applying it to security tasks is the abundance of system calls and the kind of buildup of architecture. You know, oh, back in version 1, there was this, you called terminate this way, but now there's another version called terminate this way. So with us, finding the entry point and finding data in and data out is incredibly simple by design. So we wanted to, if we were going to run this challenge in a reasonable amount of time, right? 1 year to get the whole world on board and build autonomous systems, another year to go towards a full live network event. We knew that getting people and machines onto one page meant stripping away all that complexity, so we've done it. We hope that this also makes experiments in the lab quicker to stand up, quicker to run. And we knew that we needed concurrency. So we stripped out the file system and a lot of other sources of non-determinism. I should mention, by the way, that the random For every single experiment, you have the ability to supply a source of randomness, a seed. So if you want all of the randomness that the software has available to it to be the same across experiments, that's built into the system. So we did concurrency through restricted inter-process communication. So we've released a small number of concurrent capable binaries, but it's no shared memory, just socket pairs. Challenge binaries. So no file system access. This is one of the big changes that we made to make this higher determinism. Now, of course, there is a massive gulf between reproducible experiments, which we believe were achieved well before DARPA, and or before CyberGrand Challenge, and full determinism, which I'm not certain is possible. We've just tried to be high determinism. We live in that valley, and it's a big valley. But we've been able to get a whole bunch of unplanned adversarial computer security to be high reproducible by making these changes. We hope that that you look at this corpus and its measurement properties and send us feedback about how well it works for you. We also have static linking only. So it's all user land, it's all statically linked. That means that it's a single binary and easier to reason about. We do have our own libc in a lot of these, but that's the only code reuse that was allowed. And again, it's not standard libc. Why did we do binaries? So we did make the promise during qualifiers that they would be compiled. But one of the things that you will find out when you go to any major organization that is dealing with a stream of patches that they have to make is that severity determinations are critical. And the automation of severity determinations are critical. The Bang exploitable plugin as part of Windebug is one of the great examples of the investment that's put into figuring out severity. But there are really good examples of the fact that severity can only be determined from the binary. The Mark Dowd crackadder bug, famous crackadder.c, a reduction of that published by Halvar. If you look at the severity for that bug when it was published, there were some versions of Red Hat Linux where the critical buffer, the overwrite was only a couple hundred bytes, adjoined nothing, basically null space. And so the security impact of that buffer overflow, which at the time could not be determined by static analysis. I believe that the first result that said that this buffer overflow could be found by static analysis happened only in the last couple of years at Dogstool. But even the finding of the buffer overflow didn't tell you anything from the source code about whether it was exploitable. The critical difference was whether or not the buffer adjoined control flow metadata. So even within the same operating system, there were instances where compiler choices had made this a critical where it was trivial to overwrite control flow metadata and take over sendmail with a very high level of privilege. And then just based on a different compile tool chain for sendmail, absolutely no impact whatsoever. Basically not a bug. You could overflow the buffer all the way to its limit and nothing happened. There are more examples of these, but if we're talking about taking machine agents and putting them into live competition, that severity rating, do we actually need to fix this bug, is one of the critical decisions that machines had to make. So we felt that reasoning about binaries was the logical choice. And it also should be pointed out that at this point, due in no small part to a lot of people sitting in this room, there is a wide availability of lifters, BAP, BitBlaze, Maxima, that are open source and can recover an intermediate representation from compiled binaries that are highly accurate. And most source code static analysis is a drop to IR, why not lift to IR, and reason about the binary. And then when you find a flaw, you can do that determination in the binary of criticality. Next few slides are potentially just hammering home the point that we built this thing for simple experiments and experimentation. This is Hello World in Linux, Hello World in CGC, a very Kanti-esque one byte per pixel map. We make very small binaries with no mandatory header. There it is in IDA. So what's in the box? What's in our first release of challenge binaries? There are 131 of them. They are all network services. Five are inter-process communication and concurrency. Nine are C++, 122 are C. Nine are tokenized. When I say tokenized, what I mean is that they support a very simple client-server exchange of data, where the server will say something that the client must repeat later that must be dynamically discovered, and without that protocol analysis, you can't proceed any further. About 72 CC files, a little over 1,200 header files, 2,000 C files, about 6,000 functions, 4,000 lines, 400,000 lines of code. Proofs of vulnerability, bugs. We currently know of 500 and have concrete inputs released that can access 590 flaws in this corpus. So if you want to generate a whole bunch of benign traffic, legitimate use of traffic, and mix in memory safety critical vulnerabilities programmatically in your own experiments, we have an abundance, close to 600 of these. Polls, that's legitimate use of the software over the network, around 10,000. And all of it is programmatically replayable, mixable. You can fuzz and randomize the polls and get more. What type of bugs? These are some of the big categories that were represented. We limited this to memory safety. So doing things like timing oracles, error oracles to infer secrets and that sort of thing won't work in this phase of the competition. I think anybody who reads the CVE list knows that there's still plenty of this and that machines are not perfect at finding them. On complexity, we ranged from the incredibly simple to the semi-complex. Our simplest had 8 nodes and 12 edges. Our biggest had a little over 1,000 nodes, little over 7,000 edges. These are still very small programs, right? Even at their most complex, they are very small programs. But if we're seeing a whole bunch of differentiation between automated analysis of very small compiled programs, then there's still a lot of room to move the science forward. Call graph of our smallest, call graph, well, an attempt at the call graph of our largest. So here's where we are. We started out June 3rd of 2014 looking for finalists. We had a little over 100 teams register. That bottlenecked down quite a bit. About 28 teams actually made it through our two initial dry run scored events. We've qualified 7 teams over a 24-hour event on June 3rd. So I need a disclaimer here, which is that because we are the contest organizers and because the contest is still running, I'm not going to be able to tell you how different approaches did against different challenges. And that's because as contest organizers, we may know a little bit, or in some cases more, about how the approaches work, but it's not up to us to share that, right? We have to preserve the confidentiality of the teams and their approaches. They're welcome to share it. I believe actually last week at DEF CON, Shellfish talked about one of the frameworks that they used in the CyberGrand Challenge qualifying event. But for those teams that wish to not talk about how their systems work, I have to respect that. But I can tell you what we saw on the organizer side, and I think you'll still find that's pretty interesting. We think there will be some great talks later from our competitors about playing this game. So, lessons learned. I talked before about the really, really difficult task of determinism. Back when we were first trying to get out the door just a few sample challenges so competitors could start thinking about what they were going to be faced with when they had to automatically analyze unexamined software, we had a cadet come to DARPA and write his very first C program, right? What better way to give an incredibly small sample program than a beginning programmer just learning the language? This piece of software actually went on to live in infamy amongst competitors because having just the simplest buffer overflow in the world, right? Copying 128 bytes into a 64-byte buffer introduced a massive amount of non-determinism. There were a couple of race conditions here. You could basically tear down the socket, and that socket teardown event would race the operating system to tear down the binary while the binary was racing to crash. And so on different speed computers, on different in different experimental rigs, people could either crash this service or not crash this service, and it led many of the competitors to the realization that their machines had to manipulate the socket stack. More about that later. We did our best to make things more deterministic where we could. Obviously, anybody who's read Rohammer understands that making machines deterministic is a little bit futile, but we did what we could. But there were still many lessons in humility. This is a quote from the author of Ironsides, a formally verified DNS server, who talked about the fact that security-conscious programmers, even security pros, writing C code is not enough. Not C in this case, but even so, when you have a static analyzer following the security promises that you've made about code, you will see that it reveals things to you that you did not know. And we got some very security-conscious programmers to build flaws into our software, but a huge fraction of them were discovered for the first time by machines in competition. In this case, 243 as opposed to 347. So of the 590 that we know, those are the ones that machines found first, literally before any person had ever found them. So I'll talk through my experience with one of those bugs during the second scored event when we got basically bug reports back from machines. Here's a concrete input. It's made of XML. You can play it through a replay harness, and it will cause a memory safety error, in this case a seg fault, on software you wrote. And we're playing it back, and very briefly we're playing it back against an incredibly simple C program that was literally a dictionary. So you could connect to it and ask it what a word meant, type in hacker, and it would give you a definition of a hacker from the dictionary. And this dictionary, of course, had the ability to add a word and to remove a word, which meant that we had a use after free condition that we had put in there intentionally. Add a word, remove it, then try to use a reference to that word, watch the memory safety error, see if machines could patch that autonomously. But what we got back, in addition to ways to access that bug, was a concrete proof of a bug that we didn't know about. And so I'm going to tell you how the bug worked, and then maybe you can commiserate with the 2 hours of frustration I had trying to figure it out. So the machine would look up about 25 words, and then the service would crash. So that was the whole bug. It sent 25 words, delimited by new lines, and then the service crashed. So we took every single byte that the machine had sent, and we put it into Netcat, and we pressed paste to the same service, and the service did not crash. So that's the bug. I've now told you everything you need to know about the bug. The machine sent 26 words, the service crashed. We sent every single byte the machine sent, and it didn't crash. What's the bug? It wasn't timing. It wasn't timing. I tried that too. You can trickle it in, you can run it on an incredibly fast machine. It is utterly deterministic regardless of timing. So the bug was that the machines had control of the network stack, and it sent 26 words, but it never received. Netcat always receives. And so the problem was that in the output function that sent data back, that was basically sending you the definition of the words, there was a bug in that, and it did not check to see if the socket had flushed. So if you refuse to acknowledge the data coming back as a client, then the server would just keep piling data into it as output buffer and would eventually overwrite security metadata and crash in an extremely harmful memory safety condition, because remember, you could add words, which meant that you could add your own word full of all sorts of evil bytes, and then you could look up that word and refuse to listen to the acknowledgments and then use your evil bytes to overwrite security critical metadata. Weird machines find weird machines. So, bugs are everywhere. I'm just going to put this up from Trail of Bits. We weren't the only ones finding problems in our tool sets the whole way through. IDA Pro and Intel XED. Rode with us along the way. So, a little over a year ago, we had to put some programmers on contract to build little sample programs that could differentiate automated program analysis, the absolute best program analysis we could get through an open contest. So we sat down to think about all the constraints we could put on the creation of this code that would get us something in that sweet spot in the middle, where some systems could solve it and some systems couldn't, because it would be easy to make things that were impossible for machines, well, easy for some, and it would be exceptionally easy to make something that everyone could find a bug in every time. And we decided that we couldn't do this with metrics. We actually had to create a solicitation that made our problem someone else's problem. So what we did was we made a metric. We said, if you create a challenge, I don't care how many lines of C code or its McCabe complexity or whatever, but if you create us a challenge binary, and we give it out in competition and everybody finds memory safety flaws in it, then you get 0 points. And if nobody finds a bug in it, you get 0 points. And every time that your challenge binary is solved by a unique pair, right? Two program analysis systems where only one of them could solve your binary and the other one couldn't, then that was the best possible score you could get. And we'll add up your points and they will determine whether you can continue to the next phase. So having exported our problems, we gave them absolutely zero help. We didn't tell them how any of the systems functioned and we embargoed all that information. So they were writing against advanced program analysis machines and they were doing it blind, potentially a little bit unfair. Here's what we saw. So these are the finalists. These are the top seven scoring teams. And just very simply, the white patch closest to me are the ones that nobody solved. And as we go across the salmon rainbow here, the first stripe is solved by one system, next solved by two, next solved by three, et cetera, all the way up to all seven systems. So that patch in the middle, solved by from one to four systems, allowed for a high amount of discrimination between top-tier program analysis, and it comprises well over half of the graph. So we did exceptionally well, and by we, I mean they. So hats off to our challenge binary authors doing this blind for the first time. We're pretty happy with the result. And this is whether systems were able to create a crashing concrete input. So that includes an XML file that could actually contain the logic to have a conversation when they were tokenized, as well as everything required to reproducibly navigate the program and induce a memory safety error. There's also the topic of availability, right? So when finalists were able to create a patch, did they damage the software in such a way that they got 0 points? And fortunately, this didn't happen too often. As a matter of fact, the 0 points is only two of these challenge binaries. This is availability. So with this rainbow, as we go this direction, more and more of our finalists were able to preserve some function in the software when they patched it. If you overlay these two, you will see two edge cases, right? So down at the bottom, systems were able to create understand the software enough to create a concrete input that crashed it, but there's a white stripe up there on availability. So even though they could crash it, they couldn't fix it. So what happened with those two? In both cases, it was not that they damaged the functionality of the software, but that our performance metrics bottomed out. Basically, that the competitor solutions were non-performant enough that they fell off the degradation curve and got 0 points. So one of these was a matrix multiplication application where you could give it a matrix and have it do math operations. Competitors kind of bottomed out on CPU time, on performance, when they submitted automatically patched software back to us. And we have a detailed breakdown of what happened there if you'd like it. But the other one's a little easier to talk to. The other one was a remote binary protocol designed for playing a game of Go Fish. And in that Go Fish game was a patch, right? You can see ifdef patched otherwise, where a static allocator was replaced with a dynamic allocator. And it turns out that automated systems feel highly unconfident, or their authors feel highly unconfident about replacing static allocators with dynamically sized allocators. Not surprising, but those are the two edge conditions, and that's what happened. So, of that distribution where systems were able to find bugs and synthesize the inputs that proved the bugs, what happens when we look at different types? And in this case, we have author-assigned CWE. So, starting at buffer overflow, there's a pretty good grouping amongst finalists at one end where, the black arrows at the bottom are some one of our finalist systems was able to prove a bug, and it's the same distribution from before. So hopefully you guys can see that. Buffer overflows, I think you'll see a little more resolution in the next two slides, but It mostly had to do with reachability analysis, not anything inherent in buffer overflows. We have big clustering at high differentiation, another big clustering at nearly everybody found it. Stack overflows, we had a ton of them. Looks pretty random. Heap overflows, a little more clustering, but amongst stack overflows and heap overflows, the bucket type itself doesn't seem to be a predictor of difficulty. Out of bounds read. So if you flip back and forth between out of bounds read and out of bounds write, low sample size, but the clustering looks about the same. Null pointer dereference. Machines are really good at finding null pointer dereferences. As a matter of fact, out of that huge pie slice that we got, a whole bunch of the ones that we didn't know about but machines did, null pointer deref. Uninitialized pointers, this is another one that machines are very good at. Type confusion, I should scope this. This is simple type confusion, so not object pointers being confused, but simply miscasting. This is another one where lifting to an intermediate representation and potentially bringing in stuff from the compiler compiler space was extremely effective. Input validation, we should note that we gave sample inputs, not a lot, but sufficient, which meant that because they are close to entry point usually, and because we had the sample input, all of these got solved. That was a surprise to us. Array index validation. Now we are starting to see clusters down here where there is a lot of differentiation. This is the graph for integer overflow, and we start really splitting up systems by the time we get to use after free. And you might see that cluster right there of four systems and think that that is the same four systems, but it is not. Nobody solved all of those. Off by one error, a huge clustering out here in the one to two systems alone found it. Off by ones were extremely difficult. Buffer math size, huge clustering down here at high differentiation. So if you want to pick apart advanced program analysis systems, buffer math size errors, CWE 131 seem to be a very good investment. Concurrency, again, one to two teams only solved these when they were solvable. And finally, protocol logic synthesis, so tokenization. When you actually had to create the logic in the client to talk to the server, a whole bunch of these went unsolved, and the ones that exist were solved by one to two systems. So from afar, from a contest organizer side, it occurs to us that if you want to differentiate advanced program analysis systems, don't ask them to find null pointer dereferences. They're exceptionally good at it. Ask them to solve complex protocols where they have to synthesize the client that are concurrent, that have buffer math size problems that are deep and stateful, or off by one errors or use after free, and you'll have a pretty good corpus. So one of the other things we said at the beginning, speed and scale of automation. That's good. What does it look like? I had the benefit of working with Norm Whitaker. If you go back and look at some of the early automotive grand challenges with self-driving vehicles, occasionally this person named Norm will show up on the video. Norm was a master of challenges, and he had a lot of steering guidance on the architecture of CGC. And one of the things he told me from the beginning was, never do autonomy all at once, because they witnessed that. When the first time that they built autonomous prototypes, there were just these engineering challenges to make something work. There's a huge valley between it's 90% of the way there and we only need to fix a few bugs till we can trust it with our hands off the wheel. So we didn't require autonomy all at once. We allowed some types of debugging during the qualifying event. Our rule was that a human could not be involved in solving any of the reverse engineering challenges. But if you ran out of memory and you needed to kick the server over, that sort of thing, that was allowed. And as a result, what we got was a lot of systems, not everyone, but a handful, that submitted everything at the last minute. So what you're looking at over a 24-hour event, 12 o'clock Eastern on the left, on the day that the competition started, 12 o'clock Eastern on the right, the minute the competition ended, and our 131 challenge binaries up and down the board. So this is living on the edge, right? Betting against a last minute power failure What's on the line? $750,000 and a seat at the final to win $2 million. Betting against last-minute debugging failure or what have you. And the color of our dots here says a little bit about the character of the system and what it focused on. So green is you both synthesized an input that causes a crash, and you created a successful patch that is still performant. So you comprehend a bug, and you can fix a bug, often correlated with having fixed the bug you found. Red, you could only create an input to crash it, but you couldn't fix it. So yellow, you could fix it, but you found no bugs in the software. Blue, you submitted something, and it doesn't work. So when you see a whole gigantic randomly distributed sea of red, maybe that sounds like fuzzing. When you see a whole sea of yellow or a string of yellow, that is potentially bug agnostic binary armor. And when you see a distribution of green that tails off, that is potentially a machine that is both finding bugs and fixing bugs. So we can tell less from those who lived on the edge, but we can examine this one. And it looks like a pretty mixed approach. This thing can find concrete inputs that cause crashes. It can fix some of them. It has agnostic armor when it doesn't. This is a system that found bugs. This is a system that fixed bugs and wasn't quite sure where they were. This is a system that was trying to find bugs. This is a system that was done almost instantly. That is, so in the first hour, in the first minutes of the game, and they put up their armor and they were done. So think about that during a live event. Now, if it's reacting, if it's getting new concrete proofs of input, does it have the ability to adapt its armor? I don't know. This is a system where there were almost certainly some human hands on. So anytime you see a massive submit and then it goes dark, that's usually kicking the machine over, which is the sort of thing that happens at midnight, which is right when it happened. But this looks like something that is doing distributed searching, right? You've got events happening. After the restart, you can kind of feel like there is a, you know, a diminishing returns tail. There is a whole bunch of bug agnostic patching going on here, gold dots. I'm going to attempt to ignore the competitors in this room who are trying to figure out which graph is theirs. There's a huge line when this thing gets started of unsuccessful submissions, and I'm just going to leave that to audience speculation. Potentially something about game theory in there. But this is a system with green and red dots. It is fixing bugs that it finds. It finds them, and where it can, it fixes them. It's a different approach. Not a lot of gold here. This is a system. We're going to make the speculation here that the two-hour delay at the beginning was just kind of getting things fired up, and it's not actually processing time. That had a whole bunch of really effective bug-targeted armor right at the beginning, and was both finding bugs and fixing things with a diminishing returns tail, and then had some logic to resubmit everything right at the end because we only accept final submissions. If you do what I've done and you stare at these for a while, what you will see illustrated is the difficulty of autonomy, right? The lessons of norm. So here we have a system that armored up, right? Gold. It got some generic defenses in place against memory corruption attacks. Then it found a bug and fixed it, right? That's an improvement, right? And then it started submitting replacement binaries that were wrong. So one thing that we constantly got as feedback from competitors was, why do we have to make a choice? Why can't we give you everything? You want solutions? We've got all kinds of solutions. You pick the best one. And it turns out that this is an old problem, right? People being asked to build an autonomous guidance system for cars always had possibilities about where the road was and didn't like having to pick one and then drive a vehicle out onto it and hope it didn't flip over. But if we're going to ask machines to do the entire security lifecycle autonomously, right? Proactively find bugs, proactively determine their problem, proactively fix them, monitor the network, and correct mistakes, right? So both proactive and reactive response to flaws in binary software that they've never seen in the general case, then we have to ask them to make a decision. And one of the things we heard about year one was that making that decision was exceptionally difficult. Everybody had trouble with it. Bit of background, we kind of traveled the country after the June 3rd event. So while one team was busy at home reproducibly scoring this thing over and over again on an automated scoring cluster, we had another team kind of traveling the country, visiting teams, giving them more unexamined software, getting a live demo, just kind of seeing what the technology landscape looked like. And that came up again and again. Decisions are incredibly difficult. I don't know how to speculate about this system. I'm not sure what the big blue stripe is. It actually happens over the course of an hour. Sea of red. Easy to speculate that this is fuzzing. This is a system that is constantly looking for bugs, and where there are defenses, they are often green defenses. So it's a bug. They first find a bug and then they patch it. But again, if you look closely, you can see the difficulty of decision making. So anytime you've got a transition from green to blue right at the end, that means that the machine weighed a couple potential solutions and switched from a successful patch with a successful proof of vulnerability to something that was non-performant and got a zero score. This is why we do experimentation, and also why a challenge format is the right way to move technology towards actually being able to make software changes in real time with hands off the wheel. Mistakes happen at the beginning. So that's kind of the end of our submission profile section. We've adopted the capture the flag format, right? So capture flags, prove weakness in software, defend flags, remove weaknesses in software. But another thing that we've adopted from the capture the flag format is qualifiers and winners. So I want to talk about who won this thing, where they hail from, what their road was to the challenge. So it's worth noting that we actually funded seven teams, and we had seven seats at the table, but not everyone who was funded made it through the qualifiers. As a matter of fact, of the seven teams that we funded at the beginning, three remain. Four of those slots were taken by teams that were completely unfunded. So the three funded teams that remain, Kojitsu, Dansong, UC Berkeley, authors of the BitBlaze framework, For All Secure, David Brumley, long history of both Capture the Flag competition through PPP and program analysis, BAP, TechX, this is a joint effort between Gramatech and the University of Virginia. These are the three teams that we funded that made it through open competition with the planet. The four teams that made it in without funding, Center for Secure and Dependable Systems in Moscow, Idaho, Dr. Jim Alves-Foss and Cindy, Dr. Jia Song, Deep Red, Raytheon is in this competition. Deep Red is a system built by a technology that came from a couple of their cyber acquisitions. Dissect, this is a team with a lot of Capture the Flag experience working out of a technology incubator in Athens, Georgia. Also students of program analysis, and Shellfish, working out of the lab of Dr. Giovanni Vigna at UC Santa Barbara, led by Jan Shoshitashvili. And here's where we are now. Our qualifiers are over. We have seven teams, seven seats. This is our calendar. We promised finalists by July 18th. We beat our deadline. Hats off to the qualification team. I can't say enough about how incredibly difficult it is to release 131 pieces of software in an encrypted bundle, hand out the passphrase on Twitter and three other channels at 12 noon on the dot, and run a unexamined software competition over 24 hours. Because if you think about the margin for error there, there is none. $6 million change hands based on the results, which means you get no do-overs. If the servers are down, if your power is down, if your internet is down, if anything fails to function, the whole thing basically goes up in smoke. And it didn't. And that was not an accident. It was due to the qualification team practicing every single failure case we could think of, treating every single dry run like the real thing, and coming into June 3rd absolutely prepared. So can't say enough good things about our infrastructure team, and happy to have that behind us. So let's look to the future. What's coming up is the finals phase. There are 7 program analysis teams left. And we've promised more for them to do in the second year. Now, I've talked about the fact that you don't do autonomy all at once, but we are doing autonomy in the finals phase. So crashes matter. But there's some more things they're going to have to do. Now, the big, easy to spot one that we published back in the BAA at the very beginning was, at the qualifiers phase, you have to do autonomous analysis, autonomous patching, autonomous vulnerability scanning, autonomous service resiliency, all those things. And we're going to add one thing in the final event, which is autonomous network defense. So the ability to program an intrusion detection system and automatically emit rules. But there are more differences. If you read the FAQ, I'm going to talk about some of them. In qualification phase, we just needed a crash with security implications. But that is not a good bar for a determination of security impact. It's just what we felt was reasonable within 1 year of development. So in our final event, there are 2 standards for proving vulnerability, registers and memory. So there's instrumentation installed on the remote server. And you either need to force the execution, PC, EIP, whatever you like, of the remote service to address that is specified in advance to the game server, negotiated with the game server, and in the same way, modify the contents of one general purpose register to an address that is negotiated in advance with the game server. So prove control of PC, prove control of one general purpose register. And we have instrumentation for that, for doing the scoring. Eventually will be open source and available for doing experiments like this. Or memory. There is a section of memory in the remote service whose contents are known only to the game organizers and you, if you can get it and deliver it to us, then that also proves vulnerability. So this opens up the CWE categories quite a bit. It also raises a higher bar for demonstrating both a potential memory safety problem, but also an actual security problem. The other huge difference next year is competitors basically played one round in isolation, but they never faced each other. So next year, it is round by round, head-to-head competition, which means a number of significant things. One is that if you patch something and the input no longer creates a crash, it doesn't mean that your competitors can't create a new input that takes advantage of problems in your approach. So actually evade your defenses and still prove that the software is vulnerable, or potentially find a vulnerability in what you introduced to secure the software in the first place. So that goes all the way back to the beginning about security as a field defined by the existence of an intelligent opponent. We're going to put program analysis and live patching up against an intelligent opponent in real time. And there have to be cycles because we're going to play round after round. Last year, all the binaries were compiled. We made that promise. Next year, binaries are generated by competitors. So we're not holding competitors to that promise. Machines get to do patching. Patching happens at the binary level, which means everything on the table, right? Security by obscurity, it will have its day. I've mentioned already the greater ability to debug in qualifiers and the hands-off nature of the final event. And I've also mentioned that they're going to have the ability to program a network appliance in addition to doing binary patching and replacement of software. So cycles, what are they going to look like? We don't know. I would argue nobody knows. I would argue the competitors don't know. But we can talk about the kinds of things that might be possible. And we can speculate about the role of time when you have 2 machine opponents that can work as fast as machines can, doing applied software comprehension head-to-head. So Let's start out with a really, really simplified game network. This is not representative of what the final event network will look like, but a mixing appliance in the middle that kind of anonymizes all the connections so you can't have basic ACL defense. And we're going to add the flag instrumentation. So as game organizers, we will know when there is control of PC in a general purpose register or memory contents have been delivered to us. And we will introduce to what we call in the competition cyber reasoning systems, fully automated program analysis backed autonomous systems that play this game. And there will be 7 in our final event. They will all be mixed. But in this slide, we have just alpha and beta. So what connections do they have to the network? They all get a network tap of live traffic. They all get the ability to emit proofs of vulnerability to a destination of their choosing on the network. They have the ability to submit patches onto the network through an API. So we've downloaded the software, we've patched it. Maybe it's gold. We don't know where the bug is, but we're going to fix everything. Maybe it's green. We know exactly where the bug is, and we've patched just that. And we'll submit it onto the network. And we have the ability to submit intrusion detection rules onto the framework. And there's one more connection that's incredibly important, and I'll talk about why by borrowing a slide from Mudge and his cyber analytic framework from 2010. This is a list of critical bugs that had to be fixed within the DoD in a month. 6 of them are in the actual security software meant to defend us. Shannon's Maxim, the adversary knows the system. I talked about that in the beginning. So in our game, the adversary knows the system. The last connection is consensus evaluation. Every time you submit a defense, whether it be an IDS signature or a replacement binary, all your competitors get a copy. And they can do things like differential patch analysis, evaluation of whether or not the software, maybe you put stack cookies in, and maybe you have a static seed, or maybe you have a dynamic seed, I don't know. The ability to do all that analysis automatically. And of course, Alpha has all the same connections too. So if Sage is finding a third of the automatically discovered bugs in Windows through machine reasoning and pulling them out of DoD systems before Windows is even shipped, then maybe machines can do the same thing. I think we, at this point, we have a really good proof of that from qualifiers. So if Beta finds a bug and decides to reach out and take a flag from Alpha, Alpha has the ability to just block that input with an intrusion detection signature. I don't know what this is, but when I replay it in my trace replaying dynamic analysis environment, it takes a flag. So I'm just going to block that input. Of course, consensus evaluation means that Alpha has to send that intrusion detection signature to everybody, including Beta, which has the opportunity to examine that intrusion detection signature and say, look at that. That's my input. And maybe continue to evade by making really simple changes until Alpha, through observation of those very simple changes, is actually able to create a real patch. There's no reason to believe we can't see this happen in seconds next year. We know how fast it's happening now. The Before We Knew It paper basically data mined a whole bunch of files downloaded off of public file sharing sites, the internet, and went back through it looking for signatures for known security exploits, and found that the date stamp on the first appearance of a file on the internet that took advantage of a flaw compared to the actual date of the patch of that flaw, generally 312 days. So if bugs last for about a year right now, and we can show an experiment in which bugs last for seconds and are discovered by machines, there's a lot of potential implications there. Here's another potential scenario, just one more. Alpha finds a bug, and maybe it's going to submit a green, right? I know exactly what this bug is. I'm going to do a very targeted patch, and I'm not going to send a proof of vulnerability. And I will share my patch with you, and you will reason about that patch, do the differential analysis, say, oh my goodness, I've shifted the focus of my Monte Carlo input generation over here. There is indeed a faulting input. I need to patch 2. and I'll share my patch with you, and now Alpha and Beta both know about a bug. They both know that the other side knows about the bug, and that the only proofs of vulnerability they should be emitting onto the network are going to be aimed at everyone else. So we're going to hook all these systems up to a network. We're going to let them play against each other for the first time. There is a $2 million grand prize, $1 million for second, $750K for third. Preparation is underway. It turns out that putting an air-gapped high-performance computer into a hotel in Las Vegas is a significant logistics operation, but DARPA has a history of grand challenges and people who are good at such things. So we are working on it as hard as we can. And I want to close to a thank you to our competitors around the world, both those who have made it as finalists and those who tried something very ambitious and didn't make the cut this time. We thank everybody who tried to move the science forward, who participated. And I'd also like to thank the Cyber Grand Challenge qualification team, specifically Dr. Lakhyan at AFRL and Michael Zivich, MIT Lincoln Labs, who helped build some of the data shown in this talk. So with that, I think we have time for questions. This is a small room, and I've been advised that that the pie wedge in between blocking the projector and the camera at the microphone here is incredibly small. So if you just want to shout it out, I'm happy to repeat your question and take a shot at answering it.
I have a question. Is the ability of denial of service the other team in terms, not in terms of the volume of traffic, but in terms of, for example, identifying a way in which they react that might shut down their own defenses or create a problem that defense is an acceptable policy during the game?
So question from a competitor about the final event rules. So I'm just going to say that this already walks into contested territory. We have this FAQ on our website where we answer questions about the competition. And the reason that we only ever answer questions on that FAQ is because we never want competitors to think that that one team heard something first somewhere and got that extra time to prepare. So holding a competition, we're being as objective as possible. But the question at its root was, can you DOS other teams? So I can talk about some of the constraints of the competition that are public. I said at the beginning that networking was brokered. That fact has been public from the beginning. You cannot initiate network connections. So it would occur to me that if networking is brokered and you didn't have the chance to initiate a gigantic amount of connections, that it might be very difficult to do simple mailbox flooding. But then, right, down the hill, it gets to be more muddy. What about performance processing inputs? So we've said from the beginning that we have an INETD style forking server, right, where every connection gets its own process. So it would occur to me that no matter how much you could hang up the CPU, given an input of a child, it's not going to have anything to do with the other children, which are potentially the service pullers that are measuring performance. So that also seems very difficult. However, there may be a myriad ways in which adversarial systems can mess with each other. And I'm probably not authoritative on coming up with that list, nor do I want to try.
Hi, Joe Marks from Politico. You said didn't qualify this time. Have you done much thinking about where things go after a year from now, and there'll be another round of the competition? What kind of things will you be looking at?
So you scoped that question to you. The question was, have we thought about what comes next? Is there a competition after CGC? I haven't, and the reason is that DARPA program managers are term limited. I've been here 2.5 years. 4 years is the term limit, which means at the end of this event, I will have been here 3.5 years, which is not enough time for me to run another grand challenge. So should DARPA run another one of these? It's an experiment. So I'm going to answer as a scientist and say, let's see what the experiment does. If we have an autonomous result that is not promising, then I would recommend that we let the technology grow up. If, on the other hand, we can actually show a preponderance of novel flaws being discovered autonomously, being reacted to and patched autonomously, and that this whole idea of being faster rather than being perfect actually has some merit, then it's not my call. I would fully support trying to do something down the road. But that decision is going to be the decision of a different program manager, somebody who follows me. And of course, if you want to come to DARPA, be a program manager, run challenge programs, you should send us an email. I'm unsure who had their hand up first, I'm sorry. Okay.
Wouldn't this be a good, a way to develop an ultimate offensive cybersecurity weapon, an automated machine that looks for problems and attacks it immediately? If it gets patched, it looks for another problem and attacks it immediately. So it should be used for bad purposes, for offensive attacks.
So if I'm going to restate the question correctly, it was, could this be used to create the ultimate offensive cybersecurity weapon? Did I get that right?
Yeah.
So first of all, there's a whole bunch of questions wrapped up in that, so I'm going to try to answer them all in order. Do we require systems to gain arbitrary code execution? Absolutely not. We've never asked for anything of the type. The instrumentation is designed to detect two very specific proofs of vulnerability, just like the bang exploitable plugin. So that incredibly important decision in the security process, is this a bug we should fix? That's all we do. Second, systems that autonomously discover flaws in software are already in the world, already defending us. I'm going to back up until I get to Sage, right? So DARPA's role, right, create technological surprise, means that you have to find the window in between, we're certain that's impossible, or it's proven that that can be done, right? It's kind of a vague space in between the two. So one of the reasons that we knew that this was potentially possible was that systems that autonomously find bugs in binary software exist, and they are highly important to defending real-world software. Sage works because this technology is open, the program analysis is shared at conferences like this one, and the bugs are open and fixed. So we're doing open technology development, right? We're doing this under the America Competes Act. So anyone with merit can come and play in our competition, and we've open sourced every single result. Everything that was submitted to us, downloadable for the community. So technologies are defensive when they scale and when they are open, and we're both.
I have, really two questions. One is, are your slides available? And the second is, are you excited about DEF CON challenging the CGC competitors?
Let's see. So are our slides available? The slides are distribution A, and they will be released. And I will do that as quickly after the conference as I can, as always. Am I excited about the DEF CON folks challenging our competitors? So first, I have to back up and talk a little bit about recent history. We did a CGC talk last week at DEF CON. We took crowd questions. The first crowd question came from the people who run the community contest, right, the people versus people competition, and said, it's wonderful that you're building automated systems that can play our game. Why don't we make the winner of your game come play us? So let's go back in time a little bit to the vehicle grand challenge. What would we have done if after the first self-driving car challenge, somebody from the car racing circuit had said, great that you have autonomous cars, why don't you come out and race with us? I think that they would say what I would say, which is, as a scientist, that feels really early. But we don't have the ability to direct any competitor, and I will note that the question is being asked by a competitor, to play or not to play. We're just completely uninvolved. And at the time, at the conference, I asked the competitors, he's asking a question of you, why don't you answer? And I think what we have is a highly unscientific sampling of hands raised, right? Did you raise your hand?
Yeah, we'll play. Why not?
It might be early. But again, this is an open challenge. It's open technology development. The people who develop that technology are welcome to go play against whomever they like. They can even play each other. We've said that that this competition will happen for the first time. But of course, we're not entirely in control of that. If people want to scrimmage, they're welcome to scrimmage. We just, as DARPA, don't have control where we can dictate who plays who. So it'll be interesting. It is true that when people played computers at chess for the first time, it was historic. But I will also note that machines lost. That's where we always start. And that doesn't mean that machines win is inevitable, right? I think Crazy Stone and Yoda still has to give Crazy Stone a four stone lead before they can have any kind of meaningful competition at Go. So same thing with poker, right? So there's no inevitable conclusion whatsoever. There is simply the only thing that is probably inevitable is that machines lose at the beginning. So that's what I know about that. So the question was, despite the fact that that the world chess champion is still a coveted spot, we know that a machine is not. That machines can beat people at chess, but that the very best chess player is actually a person working with multiple or a single chess playing machine. Right, man plus machine is actually the very best at chess. So I have to back up a step and note that chess is a perfect information game with a reasonable state space. That is zero sum and a bunch of other things that make it kind of machine interesting. And we're non-zero sum, imperfect information, multi-opponent, and a potentially infinite search space, plus our own problems. But having said that, what do we think about the future of this technology, and will it just be an assist? Almost certainly yes, right? The primary reason to actually do an autonomous competition is this. You can't really judge the results of a person plus technology competition, because you can have teams going up against each other where the person is amazing, right? Maybe Kasparov and Sargon, right? Or the person is no good, but the machine is amazing, right? Like me and Deep Blue too, right? And so the results of that are really hard to suss out. But with an all-machine competition, there's really good history to say that machines competing against each other get better quickly, that there is a moment, potentially, in some games where machines competing against people is really interesting, and it's around that time when those machines become very useful as an assistant to a person. So all those moments are something we want to see.
You spoke about non-performing patches. How did you delineate what was an acceptable or unacceptable performance
for a patch? We published it, and then we lived with it. So the question was, I talked about non-performant patches. How do we grade what was performant versus non-performant? So there is actually a huge and detailed PDF on the subject, which I will describe in vague terms. But the people who can describe it in expert terms are here. So if you would like to talk to them, I should actually arrange a follow-up. But basically, we measured memory usage over the execution of a single input. We measured user land performance over the execution of a single input. And we measured basically bytes on disk. And then we published a curve by which your score would degrade for each one of these. So take the and by the way, we compared replacement binaries not to the original unpatched, but to a patched by the author, right? So a defense exists, and we measure your defense versus the defense that we know to exist, right? Compare to the abilities of human experts. So for each one of those, each of the curves would impose a penalty, a kind of a gradual roll-off, and there was a point where the curve passed zero. And if you pass zero on any of them, then the availability quantity, which could be zeroed either by performance impact or by functionality loss, hit zero, and it zeroized the score for the entire binary. So for your defense to matter, it had to be both, it had to make those performance metrics, and it had to leave some use cases functioning. Good enough?
Yeah.
Okay. Again, I can introduce you after to the folks who really ran that, if you'd like.
What is the prognosis for the longevity of the execution platform on which this is all running as an experimental test bed?
So what is the prognosis for the longevity of the platform that we're running on, Decree, right? First, I'm being asked to predict, and the future often defies prediction. So let me compartmentalize this into sub-questions. What is DARPA's plans for Decree? And then, is compiled software on x86 32-bit relevant, right? So compiled software on x86 32-bit, that decision had a bunch of components. Number one, we wanted teams up to speed in a year, right? And there's a preponderance of freely available tools on x86 32-bit, but also there had to be a long-standing history of real software safety problems that could not be resolved by machines. Is memory safety still an issue? Yes. In software that we all depend on, right, to defend our identity and our banking data and our cars and everything. What about Decree? What is our prognosis for the longevity of our competition environment? Well, we're going to continue to fund and open source its development throughout the life of the program. So everything that we build to run this competition is going to be available for reproducible experiments. But past the end of any DARPA program, there is no funding continuation plan unless we run another challenge in this space. And again, that would be a decision for a PM after me. Or somebody picks up the ball. The classic case is DARPA-funded ARPANET. And after they were done, TCP and IP seemed like a really good idea, and people picked them up. So we hope people pick up Decree, but every program manager hopes for such adoption. We'll have to see. I can note that there have been a couple of open capture the flag challenges that were Decree binary formatted. So maybe the competition community will pick it up. Maybe computer science labs will pick it up as a sandbox for doing computer security competitions. My prognosis is I am hopeful. Perhaps that is it on the questions. Thank you all very much. I appreciate that.